From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today, in our weekly conversation with Professor Tony Montero, we further develop the idea of imperial retreat, with particular reference to an article published in the past week in Foreign Affairs magazine by Richard Haass, a former member of the Reagan, Bush, Clinton, Bush, and Obama administrations. It's entitled, How a World Order Ends and What Comes in Its Wake. Professor Montero, it's a pleasure as always.
The pleasure's mine, Don DeBar.
So let's start with a theme that you raised during the presidential campaign, at least. And this is entitled, the piece is entitled, How a World Order Ends, and the subtitle is, And What Comes in Its Wake.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, and if you recall, Don, we were called everything that could be called, that you could be called as an apostate, as a revisionist, as a traitor, as
Trumper. You're a Trumper.
Yeah. A lunatic, yeah, even worse than that, you know? But we see now with Richard Haass, and we have pointed to others who have some eminence, who have said pretty much what we have been saying. And now Richard Haass is not a small player in this. He's the head of the Council on Foreign Affairs, which is the most prestigious think tank in the United States on matters of foreign policy and foreign relationships. And in this essay in Foreign Affairs, which is online, it'll appear in the print, hard print copy in January. But what Richard Haass is saying is that the old order that came into existence 73 years ago is now ending.
Right.
And there is nothing to replace it with. And he queries, how do we manage the deterioration or the end of the old order?
Right.
And the problem is, he has no answers about what will come next and whether or not, I think he kind of even says that the new order will not be a U.S. or Western-dominated world order. The rise of Asia is too rapid, too profound, and certainly within the not-too-distant future, the three largest economies, national economies in the world, will be China, Japan, and India,
right,
all Asia. And the breakup of Europe that we see taking place, the chaos in the politics of Britain and Germany and now France, all of this suggests the end of an old order. The rise of Trump is not the rise of fascism, but the manifestation of a profound crisis and the urge of the mass of working and middle class people, of the poor, that we have to take care of the needs of the people in this nation and not be the overseer, the hegemon of a world order that enriches a few but impoverishes the vast 80% of the U.S. population. And they're saying the same in France. They're saying the same in Great Britain. Frankly, they're saying the same in Germany. They're saying the same in Italy,
right.
Spain. Need we go further?
Right. It's bubbling everywhere. I mean, we see
everywhere. So Haass is absolutely right. The old world order is ending. It had almost a 80-year run. Now it's over. And it's a good thing. We've called it imperial retreat. We've called it empire dismantling. We've called it any number of things, and we've pointed to the fact that when it comes to war and peace, Trump is, in fact, the most pro-peace president we've had since John F. Kennedy. Now he's talking about significant cuts in the military budget, in the next fiscal budget. He's talking about everything that we have said he might do in his first term as president. And those who do not see it, in some instances, it is because they don't want to see it. They're locked into a kind of dogmatism of theory and politics. But then there are those who have a vested interest in obscuring this.
For sure.
Yeah.
And actually, Haas points that out himself. For a little bit of context, he's an interesting messenger, in his own career. You know, you mentioned a 70 to 80 year run since, you know, the post-war order, in essence. But the Haas really comes on the scene, you know, in the setup to the Reagan administration and everything that follows since. He comes into his own then. He becomes an insider. And then he starts talking very clearly. He wrote a book, The Reluctant Sheriff, in the mid-90s, for example, where he was advocating that the U.S. play the role of international sheriff, which is an interesting thing because that had been doing that for quite some time. But he's saying that this should be official, public, you know, openly accepted policy. And he's talking about an empire that he said should be, he used the British Empire as a model. That he gave a lecture in 2000 saying that the U.S. could maintain informal control over the world when possible, but have direct control if necessary. And this is only 18 years ago. And now, at this point, and he started a year or two back saying, well, no, the world has changed. We screwed up. He refers to his own position on the Iraq War, for example. He was with Colin Powell when Powell was head of the Department of State, and that there were blown opportunities and just changing conditions, rising multipolarity, where that's no longer the case. And now he's on this thing that you're talking about, which you were talking about several years back.
Right, right. In fact, the term that you just used, going from the unipolar, i.e. the Reagan's vision,
right,
of the indispensable nation, of course, further consolidated and concretized in the Bush and Obama administrations.
Right.
Now we're looking at, really, the multipolar world. And that is what Trump has accepted. And he is literally an effective advocate from the presidency of a multipolar world. This is a less war-like world. Once you defuse or defang the U.S. military's capacity to wage any number of wars anywhere in the world, we have entered a more peaceful world. I don't know how you get around that.
Yeah. You know, Haas has got some interesting contradictions even now.
Mm-hmm.
On the one hand, he looks critically at the 2003 invasion of Iraq, including his own role in that.
Right.
He also looks critically at the Libyan war. He said he was against it, as a matter of fact. And then he turns around and says, but Obama screwed up because they should have intervened in Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, more directly. So, you know, the kind of lessons that he's learned and, you know, that I think he wants to bring to the table would have people do exactly the same thing. In other words, would be a continuity of policy, you know, dressed up as a reversal of policy.
Well, I don't know that is the case with him. See, I think like all of the neoliberal and neocon elites, they're not going willingly into the new world.
Right.
They do it reluctantly. They do it protesting all the way. But as a so-called realist in foreign policy, kind of in the Kissinger mold, he has to acknowledge and ideologically prepare the next generation of elites for the world that they will inherit. And that is not a world of U.S. domination or U.S. hegemony. And that's what I think he's saying. And he's looking at, he's saying, I support the war, I support it. No, what he's saying is he's against Russia's intervention in Syria to protect the Assad government. And he felt that there were some diplomatic and other economic pressures and sanctions that we could have put on Russia to change their behavior. But I think in this overall scheme, it is an end to the whole triumphalism of the post-Cold War, so-called post-Cold War, post-collapse of the Soviet Union moment. That is gone. In a larger sense, it is a pullback from the 73-year run, which includes the Cold War and the so-called post-Cold War moment. And he has to acknowledge that something fundamentally different is on the horizon. What that will be, he doesn't know. How China will behave, how Russia will behave, what will be, for example, the situation in Central Asia. For example, he doesn't mention it, as I recall, but Iran and Iraq, where the Iraqi government is now more pro-Iran than it is pro-U.S., and so on. And then you add to that the consolidation of the victory of the Assad government over ISIS and the Islamic jihadists, who are all backed by the United States and other Western governments. I think we're looking at a, and he is acknowledging it, this huge shift. And as Gareth Porter has pointed out, at least tepidly, could Trump represent the end of the American empire? And to that question, I say probably so. If he can survive politically and even physically.
Yeah, I mean, he's referring to that here under managing the deterioration, basically.
Yes.
This is, again, we're talking about an article in Foreign Affairs at foreignaffairs.com, Richard Haass, How a World Order Ends. The subheading, Managing the Deterioration, goes right to that, to that stuff right there.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of instructive. And I think, for example, the peace movement, to the extent that it exists in the United States, has to be informed by such thinking. You know, we don't have a real peace movement here in the United States. Right. We have advocates of certain aggressive policies of the United States. If we'd had a peace movement, we could have long ago stopped or stayed the hand of American imperialism and its role in Syria. We couldn't do it. We could do nothing about Libya and that aggression, and so on. And then, on the Korean Peninsula, the peace movement says very little about the evolution of peace and demilitarization and denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. They like to focus upon Palestine, and often in the wrong way, and make that the center of all of the world's movement towards liberation, justice, and peace. That's a huge mistake.
Right.
That's the way I would look at it. We need a peace movement. It has to be ideologically clear. It cannot be the same in form or content to the anti-Vietnam War movement. It's a different kind of thing, especially when they're not hundreds of thousands of young men being drafted into a war that they don't want to go to. That's a whole different thing from what we're looking at today. And I think that we have to reorient the peace movement, and we have to reorient the left if there is to be a serious left in the foreseeable future in the United States.
You know, there's some interesting, things being posited by... Every time I see these people come back, you know, you think after Iraq, most of them would stay like out of the way, hiding someplace, say, mm-hmm. Oh my God, are they going to have a tribunal next week or whatever? But they don't. They knock down, I guess they go home in woodshed, drink a few six packs of beer or something, and then they come back out with a new line of nonsense that says, you know, sounds exactly like the old. The major alternatives to a modernized world order supported by the United States appear unlikely, unappealing, or both. A Chinese-led order, for example, would be an illiberal one, characterized by authoritarian domestic political systems and statist economies that place a premium on maintaining domestic stability.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, come on now. Really?
Yeah.
That's all. That's the only possibility with a billion and a half to 2 billion people and a hybrid system that's being constructed as we speak, that just that one outcome must be it.
Well, I think what he's doing there is admitting that the United States has lost or is losing the ideological struggle on a world scale, that Western values are no longer appealing to the majority of people in the world. And in fact, so-called Western democracy is not a way that countries that have up to a billion and a half people in them is not the way you govern effectively such nations. Certainly, I often refer back to Africa and these 54 different countries. Africa cannot govern itself in this way.
Right.
It's too costly, it's too ineffective, and it predisposes the entire continent to neocolonialism and being picked off by various Western nations, if not multinational corporations. Yep. There has to be a continent-wide governance system that is not based upon the liberal model of every 4 years elections or every 2 years and this constant cycle of corrupt political parties running nations or regions for the sake of the super rich and multinational corporations.
Yep.
So as Asia is finding out, and it's an important thing, these large nations, which are really civilizations, have to find ways of governance which effectively delivers for the masses of people in their civilizations or societies, however you want to put it. China, with 1.3 billion, 1.4 billion people, cannot be governed like England, an island, whose wealth was based upon the colonization and, exactly. and enslavement of hundreds of millions of people around the world.
Right.
China's just not going to be run that way. So those values, even if certain elites wish to embrace them, cannot be practically applied to these large nations or these large continental regions of the world. Just can't work.
Yeah. You know, and if you look at the United States, for example, coming out of its own colonial period, I mean, compared to Africa, you had, you know, 13, 15 colonies, a bunch of, you know, large territories that weren't even incorporated into the system. But it took the unification of those colonies into one nation state with arguably immense power. For all their checks and balances, you know, the supreme power was in the federal government. And you can see how over the last two centuries, all of the attacks on that power have taken place at the state level, you know, atomized like Africa is now. You look at things like, you know, the various tax abatements, public funding of private business, all the different things, the abuses of the system that take place with everybody's race to the bottom, that's enabled by the fact that there's 50 states. You can take your factory out of New York State and take it to Tennessee or Texas or whatever. You can pay people less. You don't have to give them the right to do this or that, et cetera, et cetera. You know, Africa has that, you know, only on steroids, that condition.
That's right. So, that's right. And so, you know, the tide of history is moving towards socialism.
Yes.
You know, and it's not because evil conspirators somewhere in the world are brainwashing people in cyberspace to hate capitalism. Right. It's because capitalism has run its course historically.
Right.
And the world's people cannot lift themselves out of poverty and hunger without moving to socialism.
Right.
India, for example, has no choice. China has no choice.
Right.
They have to move towards socialism. Now, a lot of people say, well, what is socialism? Well, it will take different forms. But the transition is clear. The historical transition is clear. The West is going into retreat, is in decline, which means that the major centers of world capitalism are in decline. Such things as the China-Africa discussion and practical connections and alliances on economic, political, and other matters. I mean, yeah, it's not perfect. You know, there are a lot of cultural differences, racial issues, and so on and so forth. But the alliance between Africa and China is preferable to an alliance between Africa and the United States or Africa and the West. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
And that's what we have to accept. And certainly, I would think, and this is kind of looking at things, the logical movement of history, that that the relationship between China and Africa will speed up the processes towards socialism in China and away from mere state capitalism. I think it's very important. Now, the other thing, by the way, which didn't get a lot of press coverage, is the two supersonic, potentially nuclear-armed jets from Russia arriving in Venezuela.
Right.
And Putin agreeing to make new loans in the billions of dollars to Venezuela. Right. Venezuela is not alone in the face of U.S. sanctions, you know? And this is hugely important. But one last thing, if you don't mind, Don.
We kind of
hit on this the last time, and that is Saudi Arabia. And this whole thing that the United States, which began the war in Yemen,
right,
under the Obama administration, and which armed Saudi Arabia to fight against the popular uprising against a illegitimate government. Now, the Senate of the United States is preparing to sanction Saudi Arabia as punishment, allegedly, for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. And and the outrage and the crocodile tears of U.S. senators over hunger and desperation in Yemen. By the way, there were no tears shed over the even more desperate conditions of the Syrian people over these last 9 years or so. But that aside, but the point I think I'd like to make is that there's more to this than meets the eye. And it is that the current head of government in Saudi Arabia violated what appeared to be an agreement between Saudi Arabia, the Saudi Arabian elites, and U.S. bankers who were interested and prepared to privatize Aramco, the Saudi oil company, which is the source of state wealth and of the welfare system in that country.
That's right.
That would have been an initial stock offering of multi-trillions of dollars. It would have meant that Western banks and corporations would own Saudi Arabia. Along with that, they were proposing severe austerity upon the Saudi people.
Yeah, which of course, as we know, would mean the end of the Saudi state, because
that's right.
It's only the spreading around of all of that money among the population that keeps that state in place with the craziness that it does. It has no real base other than bribing the population, basically.
That's right. And the last thing is Saudi Arabia moving closer to China, and the trade in oil between China and Saudi Arabia no longer in what they call the petrodollar, but in the petro-yuan.
Yeah, we're seeing that kind of a dynamic happening in a number of places, and it's not an avalanche yet, and it's actually still kind of marginal in terms of the actual volumes, but they're significant numbers, they're real numbers. We're talking billions of dollars,
and it's a trend of people of nations no longer relying upon the dollar as the reserve currency. In fact, most of the trade between China and Russia is either in rubles or yuan. And certainly this thing between Saudi Arabia and China is hugely significant, in my opinion. And that means that even a country like India might conceivably trade for Saudi oil in petro rupees.
Well, let's look around the landscape. You've got Russia, the Saudis, the Iranians, and Venezuela all having an interest in trading outside of the dollar regime. Those are the supply side. That's a pretty huge chunk of the supply side. Mm-hmm. And then on the consumption side, let's just start and finish with China, who's going to be, that's about a third of humanity. So it's a pretty good size of the market.
Definitely.
Yep.
And with China, you're talking about the largest economy in the world.
That's it. So, and certainly going forward, the largest consumer economy, which means the largest consumption of all of those things. All right, we got to stop here, Tony. Thanks a lot, and we'll speak with you again next week.
Thanks a lot, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.